done for divided families. As you may know, that this past week there's also been an exchange of soccer teams, so that a friendship game was played between a team from the North and a team from the South in Seoul. And North and South Korea have agreed also to participate together in the Busan Asian Games, flying at those games a unification flag, which also is symbolic of a very dramatic shift in the possibility for reconciliation.
As you alluded to earlier, the Korean Red Cross Society is helping to reunite a few of the millions of family members living apart across the north and the south border in Korea. Last week, 100 North Koreans met their South Korean relatives for 3 days. During one exchange, a 93-year-old Kim Hae-yeon from South Korea held his 90-year-old wife from North Korea and asked, "Can you recognize me?" and said, "You're alive. Thank you. I've waited for this day." Please take some time and tell us about how millions of families were separated during the war and the impact of that separation.
Well, I think that this is a story of Korea that is very difficult to communicate, in words, certainly, and in a very brief kind of way. I think for people who don't know the situation, the few opportunities that the U.S. media has provided to see visual pictures of these reunions that have taken place over the last several years gives an indication of the depth of the emotion that's associated with having found, as you're describing in the instance you mentioned a moment ago, people who have lived their lives apart from each other for many, many years, and then coming together initially, perhaps not even recognizing one another at first, but then often rather suddenly and rather dramatically beginning to feel the emotional tie that they've never lost. I don't know how one describes that in words, but this is not something that simply a small number of Koreans have experienced. The estimates are that there are currently 10 million divided Koreans on the north and the south, so that nearly a fifth of the population on the peninsula experiences this personally and directly, and probably everyone does through at least distant relatives. So the human drama in this, what we hope will be an historic moment today, is in a sense beyond description, but at the same time, I suppose, can be imagined if one thinks about what it would be like to have been separated from a mother, a father, a sibling, to have constantly wondered and thought and have been uncertain about the fate of one's loved ones, and then almost in a dreamlike state to have this very brief reunion. It's overwhelming, and some people think that it may even be more difficult to cope with having had this opportunity to be reconnected for a brief moment, and then to be separated again for an unknown future period of time. For example, the earliest reunions took place when people knew that after that 2 or 3 day brief contact, they were likely again never to see their relatives. What makes today perhaps different, with the possibility now of a permanent reunion site, is that Koreans who go through this experience and have the opportunity to be reunited may not have to think of it as a last time, a last opportunity, a one-time-only opportunity.
You are a professor of psychology at Boston College, Ramsey Lim. You're also the director of the Oral History Project there. And I also know that this has a personal impact on you. Your family is from the North. Could you talk about how this has impacted on your own life?
You know, I think in some ways similar to many Koreans who live in Korea, but also in different ways. You're right, my parents are originally from the northern part of the peninsula, but that was before the nation was divided. They had come to the States in the 1930s, still thinking of their homeland as whole, as unified. And then following the rupture, following the several decades of military dictatorship in the South, their lives became, while fully sort of engrossed in becoming Korean Americans, their lives were still in constant ways directed back to the struggles that were ongoing on the Korean Peninsula. And both my mother and father were deeply involved in efforts towards reconciliation and unification. So that, as I imagine today, thinking about them, they both passed away. I'm sure that their spirits and their sense of having made small accomplishments in their lives by trying to contribute to this process of unification would have been very positive today. They would have experienced a sense of elation. Their work and their commitment on behalf of unification and reconciliation has also affected the lives of their family, their children, and their children's children, so that without going into any detail, I can say quite confidently that my generation of the Leems and my children's generation continue to share in the desire and in the ambition of my parents to see a unified Korea. And so I personally take gratification in being a part of this process as well.
What are your first youngest memories of this dialogue, of learning about this history of your family and your country?
My recollections as a child are hearing on the radio that some kind of a war had broken out someplace in a place called Korea, thinking of myself as somehow connected to that, but not knowing clearly how. And also recalling 3 years later that somehow this terrible situation had come to an end. Knowing that my father had returned to Korea just before this period, with some vague sense that his going back had something to do with the possibility that one day we too as a family might return to Korea. Having vague recollections of the few Koreans living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at that time, where we were coming to the house, eating bowls of noodles and talking endlessly about something having to do with important events taking place in their home country. So these are sort of a child's sense of activity, periods of ups and downs in parents' emotions, and somehow not being able to connect that with the actual events that were taking place at the time. But, of course, in retrospect, knowing that this was, in a sense, a Korean-American child's introduction halfway across the world to what was beginning to take place on the Korean Peninsula around the period of the Korean War.
Just as North and South Korea were warming their relations, George Bush named North Korea in his January speech as one of the axis of evil. Well, he also said recently, "I will remind the world that America will not allow North Korea and other dangerous regimes to threaten freedom with weapons of mass destruction." I'm wondering what your response was to hearing Bush use that axis of evil phrase, given the kind of progress that had been being made.
Well, I think the key is what you've just said. It was thinking about this new, quote, Bush administration policy, if we could call it a policy, coming fast on the heels of what many of us had hoped would be and thought was a serious step towards a reconciliation between Washington and North Korea, led at the tail end of the Clinton administration by people like Madeleine Albright and ultimately, you know, all of our hopes that Clinton might visit North Korea himself. So he left office, and I think many of us continued to have a guarded optimism that if the Bush administration looked carefully at the situation on the peninsula, they might come also to realize that there was more to be gained by a negotiated solution to our differences as opposed to a more antagonistic and aggressive. So it's in that context that this concept of the evil axis, associating North Korea with it, came as a terrible, well, I can't say entirely as a shock, but as a blow to our hopes that we might continue to build on what the Clinton administration had done. In fact, so much so that people in the Boston area decided to try to organize some kind of effort to begin to gradually publicize and educate the local community here as much as possible about North Korea as a nation of people, you know, as opposed to a country, you know, with a demonized leadership and very narrow and antagonistic stereotypes associated with them. So the Boston Korea Friendship Association was sort of brought into existence in an effort to create an opportunity for more people-to-people understanding between the American public and hopefully in a face-to-face way at some point the people of North Korea.
Before we say goodbye, Professor, I'd like to ask you to elaborate on the significance of these actions being taken, if you will, independently by the North and the South.
In addition to the dramatic possibilities that the opening of the border to these railroads and to the accompanying highways that will run alongside them, and the permanent reunion location and the exchange of sports and cultural activities, is the possibility that these steps are now being taken by the leadership of North and South Korea, particularly the leadership of South Korea, with a clear understanding that if progress on the Korean Peninsula towards unification and reconciliation is in fact going to take place, decisions and policies have to be made perhaps somewhat more independent of the influence of Washington. We all know that South Korea and the United States have been allies over the years, but we also know that that relationship has not always been a mutual relationship. And I personally believe that with the Bush declaration of North Korea as part of the evil axis, something may have happened in the leadership circles in South Korea. People may have woken up a bit more to the fact that U.S. interests in Korea and Korean interests in its own nation are not always identical. I know in the Boston area, when we publicized one of the first programs of this friendship association, Korean merchants were very concerned that the declaration of North Korea as an evil axis upped the ante in terms of the possibility of a renewed armed conflict on the Korean Peninsula. And regardless of ideological differences among Koreans, everyone knows that if war were to break out on the peninsula, everyone would lose. So I believe that some of what we're seeing this week may in fact reflect something of a turning of the corner by, or at least this is a hope by the leadership in the South, a recognition that ultimately reconciliation and unification has to come independently and above all peacefully.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Ramsey Lim. You are a professor of psychology at Boston College and the director of the Oral History Project there on the impact of the Korean War. And on this very significant day, we are delighted that we could speak with you and begin to talk about this process of reunification between the South and the North. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Dennis.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we stay with the story of the U.S. naval terrorist bombings of Vieques. And joining us for an update is our Vieques special correspondent, Professor Deborah Santana of Mills College. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Well, Vieques came up in a press conference that was mostly about Iraq, and Rumsfeld was asked about the alleged attacks by civilians on the military in which the local police did not respond, did not protect the military. Would you talk about Rumsfeld's response and its revealing nature in terms of, like, putting the lie to the idea that the occupation of Vieques, the bombing, is going to end?
Yes. First, I just want to mention that he was responding to reports only that he seemed to have heard from the reporters that, according to the Navy, the Navy security personnel were being attacked by protesters from the other side of the fence with flares and with stones, and that they were responding to that, that any tear gassing was happening as a result of that. Now, that actually has been repeatedly denied by both people, the protesters, by observers, by reporters, and also by the Puerto Rican police, who have actually arrested people who they had thought were breaking the law or about to break the law. And the interesting thing was, is about to break the law, those things don't really stand up in court, and those charges have been dismissed. I suppose the Navy is upset about that. But then when Rumsfeld responded to that, he says, well, if this is taking place, and he did not say that he believed that he said, if this is taking place, and he did say he didn't know, he says, how to place form this gracefully, places law enforcement people have to do their duty. Then he says, Vieques is an important location for us, and we intend to continue to operate on a basis that's consistent with our obligations, and we hope others will continue to operate in a manner that's consistent with their obligations. Now, when you take this in the context of the oft-repeated verbal statement by President Bush and by the Navy that they should be leaving by May 2003, and contrast that with the fact that the Navy has been building various support sites inside the Vieques Range, and that they have been signing contracts to operate the range. For example, ITT Corporation has a signed contract to operate the range until 2005, and the Navy also requested a permit from Fish and Wildlife Service to say that their bombings are compliant with endangered species concerns, and the permit is for doing bombings and other operations until December 2006. And the fact that there is nothing in writing yet that actually says that the Navy will be packing up and leaving by May 2003, that becomes very worrisome.
Now, clearly there has been a post 9/11 heightened intensity, a vigilance, if you will, on the part of the Navy to say not even to do the niceties. Could you talk about the growing tension that's happening at the base, at the gate, in the confrontations between occupied people of Vieques and the military?
Yes, I can especially even talk about things that I witnessed firsthand in July of this past summer, when there were not even any protests going on or any maneuvers going on, that the Navy personnel would get very close to the gate. And in fact, they're operating the gate these days. Sometimes it would come out of the gate, and they would turn on their pepper spray machine, and it would just turn it on. And, of course, it all blows in our direction. And they're standing around laughing about it. Very much provocative actions. One night, they went down to another camp. We have several camps near the fence, and one of the camps, they went down tonight and started throwing mangoes at the people who were sitting there. Then you add that to their activities during these bombings, which are still taking place for 3 weeks in Vieques. And they have been doing nightly sprayings with tear gas and pepper spray in some of the lower camps. Not the camp that's directly in front of the gate very much, because that's where most of the reporters congregate. But they'd be going to the other places and then going up into a area called Monte Carmelo, which is a community where there is very heavily populated, and they've been throwing incendiary devices nightly, and they've come very close to burning down some people's houses.
Back to this statement by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld about the Vieques being essentially a permanent part of U.S. operations, naval operations there. Has there been a response from the governor of Puerto Rico? After all, she's the one who's been repeatedly lied to by George W., and obviously we can see the lie because he has Rumsfeld verifying it.
Yes, actually, this is something that has just happened. And I want to also point out that nearly every single Puerto Rican governor, obviously doesn't include the military U.S. governors who were the governors of Puerto Rico before that, but nearly every Puerto Rican governor has attempted to resolve this issue of Vieques, only to back off because of certain threats and also certain promises coming from Washington. And we had suspected with Sila Calderon this was no different. She has repeatedly said that she supports the Navy leaving, like, tomorrow, if possible, but in any case, no later than May 2003. But she was refusing to ask Bush to put it in writing in an executive order, which is something that we actually have a campaign going on. There have been about 30 congressmen that have just recently written to Bush on this. And she keeps saying that I believe his word. We were pretty much sure that she is trying to walk this tightrope and deal with the special pressures that a colonial governor is subject to. But what happened yesterday, after it became public, Rumsfeld's statements, which could be interpreted as saying the Navy is not leaving, she finally wrote a letter to President Bush asking him to put, in very, very clear terms, to put his promise to her in writing in an executive order, and also suggesting a number of options by which they can formally begin the transition for the Navy leaving Vieques. She also wrote a letter to Rumsfeld, and she basically told him what has been going on in Vieques, that it's in fact been the Navy's own personnel who have been very provocative, that none of the their so-called attacks on them have been can be confirmed. In fact, we do have a report that some unknown person came up to one of the camps one night and then started shooting flares into the Navy area, and the people in Vieques have no idea who this person was. So you can draw your own conclusions. And she basically said to him that your own personnel have a responsibility not to provoke these situations, and that you need to talk to us. We are fulfilling our responsibilities, and see, and by the way, we don't want your statements to be misconstrued as contradicting the policy of the president, which is that the Navy should leave Vieques by May 2003. It was very, very interesting because she has been very resistant to actually doing this. And yesterday they came out and she immediately made them public. It's, what can I say, we're actually fairly excited. And I just have to say that public pressure does work sometimes. So.
Now, of course, a part of your battle is the fact that there is apparently going to be a major war in the Middle East against Iraq if the administration has its way. And so all aspects of the military are on alert, and they're not going to be giving up a camp at Vieques or anywhere else, because it may be that these forces don't go to the Middle East, but they have to sort of keep the hemisphere intact in order while the military is busy expanding empire in the Middle East.
The Navy also is kind of in a contradictory position here. On the one hand, you have many of their own top leaders, both recently retired, such as Admiral J. Shanahan, Admiral Jean Carroll, and those who are on the watch right now, such as Admiral Robert Nader, saying that the Vieques training is basically obsolete, and they can do everything that they do in Vieques equally or better in other places. So on the one hand, they themselves have even said that, and there is a Center for Naval Analysis report that is being held from publication, which we suspect that it says the same thing, because their original report basically came to that conclusion. But on the other hand, there are certain elements within the Navy and their supporters in Congress, such as Senator James Inhofe and Republican Congressman Hansen, that they believe that they need to use the Iraq issue to reinforce not leaving Vieques, and that it sends a bad signal. This is also, I believe, several of them have made a lot of money on the contracts. So there's a funny little contradiction that the Navy has to deal with, and we just have to keep hammering on this. Even if you agree that they need to be doing this kind of training, there is absolutely no argument saying that it has to be in Vieques, where so many people live.
Well, after all, they could occupy Martha's Vineyard or, some of the islands off Maine where the Bushes go fishing, and try that for a little while.
Or some of the 600 unoccupied, uninhabited islands that are along the eastern coast of the United States.
Of course, we're not going to see that happen. Finally, we only have a minute left, but last we spoke, Robert Rubin, a major activist there at the gates fighting against the bombing and the occupation, was being held in isolation, deprived of his rights. What's the situation now?
Robert Rubin is currently on a fast. He is fasting for every day that the Navy is bombing. So he has been fasting since September 3rd. We don't have any direct contact with him because they are not allowing him to buy any stamps. They're not allowing him to receive phone calls or make phone calls. They're not allowing him to receive any visits except for some attorneys. And so, in fact, there are a whole group of attorneys that are going to do a sort of like a relay visit to Bob. They're going to be calling, and I believe they're going to be doing it this weekend, where a whole lineup of lawyers is going to go and consistently ask to see him. From what I understand, he actually sent a message to protesters on Sunday who did a huge protest simulating a massive entrance into the Navy base if they don't leave on May 2003. He sent them a letter of solidarity, so his spirits are good. We don't know his condition physically. He is supposed to be let out in October 7th, and we're very much looking forward to that. I also want to say that we received many letters of support, and the prison got some phone calls, also from the United States and from Puerto Rico, and he was taken out of solitary.
Well, before we say goodbye, why don't you tell our listeners again how they might participate in this in terms of getting in touch with Robert Rubin, the authorities, or knowing more about the situation and the resistance to the bombing and the occupation?
I would say probably the best way to get information is to look on the web, www.viequeslibre.org. You can also call the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques directly, and that's area code 787-741-0716. And I would remind people that it does make a difference to fax the White House, and that White House number would be 202-456-2461.
Deborah Santana, professor at Mills College, major activist in the battle to end the bombing and the occupation of Vieques. Thank you so much for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
And for those of you listening in the Bay Area, we have an announcement regarding a series of talks being given by independent researcher John Judge entitled 9/11 and Future Wars. Judge will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at the Women's Building in San Francisco, located at 3543 18th Street. And he'll be speaking tomorrow night, also at 7 p.m., at the Humanist Hall in Oakland, located at 411 28th Street at Broadway. For more information, call 415-648-8472. That number again, 415-648-8472. And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein, with associate producers Yun Su and Leslie Kane, and contributing producer Robert Knight. Our technical directors are Mary Bishop and Rangita Giesler. For a taped copy of this broadcast, call 510-848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to John Lionheart, our web maestro, and thank you for listening.
Eagle Moiety and Shark Clan from Juneau, Alaska, and my great top white man name is Eileen Boston, and I live in Oakland now for 30 years. And Gunasheesh, my language. Thank you all for listening to Earth Songs and KP.